I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
In the coming years, when you catch a flight from Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, which has been owned by the city of Atlanta for like ever, will someone else be in charge? In fact, who's in charge here is a pretty good question about a lot of what's gone on politically in these parts lately. The two major party candidates for governor accused each other of failing to be in charge of their own finances. A school superintendent appeared to go on a racist rant, and Georgia Tech's president felt compelled to promise, "We're going to work really, really hard to stop financial abuse." Must mean it's time for a new edition of The Political Breakfast. You are cordially invited. I'm Dennis O'Hare, and we've got the band back together. After weeks of sitting on the sidelines, Brian Robinson is back. He's a Republican strategist, former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is here, too. He's a former National Southern Regional Director of the Obama 2012 campaign. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Got to shake the rust off a little bit here, but I was hoping there would be some kind of intro music for me, you know, Eye the Tiger.
It was good to see you, brother. I mean, didn't feel right all these weeks you've been gone. But
I told him, I appreciate Chuck and Lynn filling in for me. I told him, hey, go do a good job. Hold Theron's feet to the fire. But don't be too good.
Right.
Don't be too good. And I think that they did that.
They did a great job.
They did a great job.
And welcome back, man.
Our thanks to former Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, one of Brian's old bosses, also to former state GOP chair Chuck Clay, and to former city council president Kathy Willard, who filled in once when Theron couldn't make it. So
I think, and Michael Owens as well.
And Michael Owens, yes.
Yeah. Yep. So we make sure we cover
Cobb
all these
Democratic chair. So.
These folks, because if I decide to jump on one of these races coming up, like Brian did, maybe they can come fill in for me a little bit.
Let's start with the ever-changing world in Washington and whether it affects the elections coming up in Georgia. Democrats Theron pounced when President Trump's former personal attorney and fixer Michael Cohen pled guilty to attempting to influence the 2016 election by arranging those hush payments to two women who claimed they had sexual relations with Mr. Trump. And then the president's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, found guilty on 8 counts of financial and tax wrongdoing. But do Democrats, with their convention this weekend, think they can leverage this here in Georgia congressional races, especially the 6th and 7th, which Democrats have looked at as possibly winnable?
Well, we've known since day one that Donald Trump as a candidate and now as a president has been a walking conflict. He basically lied on whether or not he actually knew information or actually participated in a deal to basically give a porn star money to go away and to basically strike a deal with her. I think what Georgia Democrats have got to continue to do is have a very Georgia-specific campaign strategy, but figure out ways to amplify this chaos that we're seeing in Washington.
And how do you thread that needle? Because if you're just talking about Trump, you're not going to win those districts.
Well, to be honest with you, I think that there are so many challenges that we face in this state, and Governor Deal has done a good job of managing a lot of those and meeting those challenges, but there's still the issue around job creation and rural health care and making sure that we give our children an opportunity for a first-rate education. So I think you got to focus on those, but I think you can really talk about the leader of the Republican Party. This is the president of the United States of America. He sets the tone for his party. And at a time when he has been very involved in the congressional elections, gubernatorial elections, and even all the way down to some state and local elections across the country, Republicans are going to have to defend their leader. They're going to have to defend the type of behavior and the type of unlawful activities that are going on around him. Now, I believe that 90% of Republicans in Georgia that support Donald Trump is probably dwindled a little over the last few weeks. I would say that I think it's more close to maybe 70 to 75%. But we do know one thing about campaigns is that he is still the president. He still has a unique ability to fire up a base of people who are going to crawl over broken glass for this president. But I do believe with these two these two incidents that just happened, a guilty plea and a guilty verdict on people who had an intimate relationship with this president when he was being a businessman, definitely hurts his credibility.
Brian, if you're Brian Kemp, the Republican candidate for governor, you've already locked yourself in to President Trump. But if you're Karen Handel or Rob Woodall, the incumbents in the 6th and 7th congressional districts, you have some wiggle room here. But how do you finesse that?
Well, one thing that boxes them in to some degree is, as Theron said, they do have to go defend the president because their voters want the president to be defended. They believe in what the president is doing. None of them, these voters who support Trump and like what he's doing, are there because they think what he did with Stormy Daniels was okay or didn't happen. They don't have any denial about what he's done in his personal life.
But
they like the direction the country's going.
But I haven't heard either one of them yet rush to defend the president. They haven't condemned him, but they haven't rushed to defend him either.
But that's within a context, Dennis, of a congressional delegation that we never hear from. And why is that? Well, it's because there's no media source that covers the Georgia congressional delegation. There is no platform from which we're going to hear from them. They're not walking down the halls of Congress getting reporters shouting questions at them for their daily deadlines. That is a relic of the past. That is not what we have. And we never hear from our congressional delegation. I bet there is an infinitesimal number of Georgians who can name a congressman who's not their own, and I bet you a large percentage
John Lewis,
of them
probably
couldn't name their own. Yeah. It's very hard to get attention from that, and that's going to be a challenge for Karen Handel and for Rob Woodall. They're changing demographics in the Woodall district. Karen Handel's got a lot of college-educated white people, as well as a certain level of diversity, but college-educated white people who have been the ones shedding from the Trump coalition.
Well, that district didn't go for Donald Trump anyway during the Republican primary.
That's right. And she won by a healthy margin despite $40 million being spent against her. That's something that's definitely going to play in her favor and make her look like this is winnable. But she has got to thread the needle, and she's doing a good job of it. But she's got to stick to more traditional Republican principles, like being, she came out against the tariffs that the Trump administration was for. So that's an example of how she distances herself when Trump is outside the mainstream of her district. But in large part, she's going to say, hey, he cut taxes, he's appointing conservative judges, et cetera.
So Brian definitely is rested and he's back, and I'm so happy that he has mastered this spin. But here's the reality, right? And he knows this. A lot of these college-educated Republicans that Brian and I talk to, many of whom we actually represent through our businesses, they're saying the same thing we're saying, right? They're saying that this president is unhinged. This is the type of behavior that we're really ashamed of. But to Brian's point, what's so, you know, sort of unbelievable is that I believe a lot of these still college-educated Republican voters are going to vote for Trump unless Democrats can give them a viable alternative solution that's based on fiscal responsibility. One of the things that's really missing from all of this Trump controversy, Trump ran on a platform of going to Washington to drain the swamp, right? And since he's been there, I mean, he's had up to 10 people now either on trial who are being investigated or who've actually been indicted or who actually have gone to jail or going to jail. And so this swamp that he was talking about is still very unpopular. And so I think for Congresswoman Handel and Congressman Woodall, they still have this challenge of the majority of American people and Georgia voters do not like what's going on in Washington. They think that Washington is broken. They think that Washington does not work for them. And so Democrats have got to figure out a way to not only tie Trump around their necks, but also to talk about how things are not really getting done in Washington. Now, I would say this. I thought Karen Handel had a brilliant strategy with her recent commercial ad.
She's talking about sex trafficking.
Talking about sex trafficking. Probably got out there a little bit before this whole deal between Trump's personal attorney, who did admit that he paid off a porn star. I want to keep emphasizing that Donald Trump lied and said he did not have a sexual affair with. But she is trying to go back to some sort of the more the compassionate conservative part of the Republican Party and what is left of it. And I think that a lot of those voters in her district and in Woodall's district, that's the type of Republican messaging that they're used to.
Along those lines, let me give some unsolicited advice to Woodall and Handel. One of the major issues that we've seen in the governor's race, and this goes back to 2014 and in this one, has to do with access to the marijuana cannabis oil, which is very hard to get. In fact, illegal to get from other states.
You can possess it, but you can't get it.
But you can't get it.
So it's a catch-22 under Georgia law.
And the problem is they can't go over state lines because of federal law. So I would love to see Karen and Rob come out supporting legislation that allows the interstate move of cannabis oil so that these kids and people who have PTSD from their veteran service, people who have chronic pain management, that they can get access to this. I think it polls over 80% statewide. So you got to think in the 7th and 6th districts in suburban Atlanta, it's even higher.
Let's pivot now to the governor's race. Brian, I'll start with you on this one. Both candidates in the last few weeks have hammered each other on personal financial issues. Brian Kemp's ads talk about Stacey Abrams' income tax debt. Kemp himself has been in court this week because he brokered a loan that he guaranteed for a company in which he had invested. And when that $500,000 came due and the company failed to pay, the plaintiffs argue that Brian Kemp didn't live up to his guarantee and pay up. But you of all people would know that a certain governor won 8 years ago in the middle of a campaign where his personal finances were an issue, and he won anyway. So is this a winning strategy for either Kemp or Abrams to beat each other up over this?
Hypocrisy alert, because I was part of the Kegel campaign attacking Brian Kemp over not paying his bills that he personally guaranteed. And I was part of that give and take.
And we all know how that turned out.
Yeah. I think we can safely say the election did not pivot about whether or not he paid his bills that he owed or not. I don't think that this is going to be make or break. I think what's different is the Stacey Abrams case has got to do with paying taxes, not having to do with something having to do with business.
She is on a payment plan, though.
She's on a payment plan, but she did have $50,000. And instead of paying what she owed the federal government the way the rest of us do, she seeded her campaign for governor with it. So there is legitimacy in the Kemp argument that she put her obligations to the government behind her obligations or desire to further her political career. I think that's an utterly legitimate argument and one that rings true, particularly at a time when she is calling for higher taxes. She won't pay her taxes, but she wants you to pay more is a really good argument and it's strong.
But will
it different.
Matter?
I think in today's tribal politics that her voters aren't going to move off of her because of it. Kemp's voters aren't going to move off of him because of it. She has done a good job, and Kemp, too, of saying, yes, I have had financial problems in my past. I think that's something that relates to people because most people in the last 10 years coming out of the Great Recession have had to make tough decisions about their personal finances, maybe lost their own home or didn't get a better job or stuck in a bad career for a while. We've all had hard times because of it. So I think that you can use it for sympathy, but I found the fact that Stacey Abrams came out with an ad defending not paying her taxes. In August, she goes up on the air spending lots of money. What that tells me, Dennis, is that they pulled that issue and it was very damaging to her. Because if it wasn't, they wouldn't be spending this much money this early in the campaign.
Yeah.
Let's really walk our listeners through this whole financial situation. I made a comment in the AJC about 6 months ago with Jim Galloway. And I said that I think that the campaign for governor on the Democratic side and the Republican side is going to be about personal finances and personal conduct. Now, we had a lot of personal conduct issues during the Republican primary, right? I think Brian would say that he really wished that his candidate probably didn't sit down with a particular individual and actually have a conversation, right? And I think that Brian Kemp probably wished that he had not entered into this loan agreement, which has not been paid with this particular company. But then when you get to the financing of it, yes, Stacey Abrams, I think, brought a level of humanization to this issue. And this was something that not only did she identify with polling that would be something that she needed to address right away, it came up during the Democratic primary. And the way that she was able to really speak to the majority of Americans and basically saying, hey, I had to make some tough choices. When my father became ill, when he had to actually get treatment for his cancer, as one of, I think, you know, many siblings, I had to step up and really make some tough financial choices. One of the things that I think that doesn't get said enough, Dennis, is that she has not ran away from the fact that she does owe money to the IRS, and she's on a payment plan to repay the money upwards to $50,000. But one of the things that's being overshadowed is that each year she has filed her taxes. She has reported accurately. She just has not been able to pay them. In the case with Brian Kemp, it's really interesting that he has shifted, because for a long time in this state, if you're a Republican, and I don't ever want to bring race into it, but I don't know a lot of black Republicans running for office in Georgia, so you have to say majority of them have actually been white. It was sort of this thing where in the Deal days, when Deal was running, yes, we knew Governor Deal was basically on the verge of possibly being censured when he was running for governor. We knew that he had a lot of financial issues, but I think 8 years prior, people gave him the benefit of the doubt because people saw a president and President Obama who was ethical, who never had questions about his financial stability. So fast forward 8 years later, we also have a president who's filed bankruptcy upwards to more than five times. And so I do think it will matter, Dennis, because what it does in for you in the campaign, it attacks your credibility. And one can ask both candidates, if you're not able to manage your business dealings when you are supposed to repay a loan and you haven't repaid it, and to be fair, Stacey Abrams, if you've made some tough choices and made some money, obviously, but you wanted to continue to pursue your dream of running for governor and you gave money to your campaign and didn't pay off your IRS bill, I do think it forces both of those candidates to tell the people of Georgia, how would you manage the state's money and the people's money if you are elected governor. And so I think that what the Abrams campaign did was a good counterpunch to the Kemp attack that they anticipated that was going to come very early on in this general election.
You know, one thing I remember, I had to deal with this because I, for those who don't know, I was Governor Deal's spokesman at the time in 2010 dealing with this. And there are all these stories in the AJC and WSB and Fox 5 and all, everywhere about any minute now this guy's going to go bankrupt. And I kept saying, no, he's not. I'm talking to him right here. I'm looking at his finances. He's not about to go bankrupt. He's lost a lot of money in the Great Recession, but he's going to be able to cover it. He's going to be okay. And I just kind of got condescendingly patted on the head. Ah, oh, Brian, you're a moron. You know, Nathan Deal's obviously a crook and going to go to debtor prison, blah, blah, blah. None of it ever happened because none of it was true. As is many things in our first term and in that campaign, what Deal was saying was proven right over and over again. Different topic, I know. I don't think that this is going to be make or break for either candidate. I do think that there is a substantive difference between not paying your taxes that impact us all and how you manage your business or a business that you are a member of as a part owner. I think the fact that she gave money to her dad's cancer treatment is noble, and I understand it, and I know she's telling the truth about that. But it is very unfortunate for her that the $54,000 that she owed the IRS is so close in value to the $50,000 that she gave to her own political ambitions. That is damning, and it is on the air, and it's making an impact. I think Democrats are worried about that message.
No, but let me push back on that. And I think the thing about this is, listen, majority of Americans, and a lot of them are Republicans, have figured out a way to manipulate the tax system. I mean, we have a president right now, I keep bringing this back to Donald Trump, so maybe I'm going to make everything about Donald Trump because it's very popular right now. But we have a president who's sitting in the White House who admitted that he figured out a way to manipulate the tax code, to manipulate the current tax structure that we have in the country. And so I think that Stacey Abrams made a game time decision to say, okay, and I know what Brian is alluding to, and let me just say this because I think this is what, if I was on the campaign, this is my unsolicited advice, and I think I can say this as a person who's not officially working for the campaign, is what the Republicans want you to believe is that she intentionally tried to dodge paying her taxes, which she generated by running a very successful business or businesses, and therefore that makes her kind of un-American. That makes you not really sort of fit to want to run for office, like you're supposed to pay your taxes. But what baffles me, Dennis, is that I didn't never hear any Republican saying that about Donald Trump, saying that, hey, Donald Trump, if you want to run for president, if you want to do all this stuff, pay your taxes, show us your tax return.
There is the drumbeat still.
But
about your tax return? Show
right.
us your
and
returns.
So
people
have a president
are raising
right
that.
Now who won't release any of his tax returns. Stacey Abrams has released her tax returns. I go back to the Brian Kemp situation. Stacey Abrams right now is on a payment plan. Stacey Abrams is paying her money back. Brian Kemp, technically, I mean, if we want to go there, it's actually being investigated and actually is on trial and being sued.
This is a civil case, we should point out.
But here we go. If we want to get in a message, this is why me and Brian get paid the big bucks. What I would be saying if I was Abrams' campaign, yes, I have a payment plan. Yes, I owe the IRS money. But I'm not being sued. I'm not in a civil lawsuit. I'm not having to, you know, get deposed and go into all these different court orders and really have this guy who's on television saying that Brian Kemp owes me this money. That may be something that they want to talk about. But overall, I agree with Brian. It's not going to make or break the campaign. It's not going to cost him the election. But it does sell newspapers. It definitely makes digital clicks go up. And it gives us an opportunity to talk about it.
Let me close off there by saying, Abrams seems to be taking a calculated risk of not attacking Brian Kemp. And I'm not quite sure why. I'm sure that there's some
She's
strategy.
She's letting the state Democratic Party do it, though.
Somewhat. That was a state Democratic Party ad where she's talking about her dad having cancer. They never pivoted to an attack on Brian Kemp about
Sure, but
in their
press releases, in their messages to media, they have been focused on Brian Kemp's civil lawsuit for a week at least now.
What I'm saying on the air, on TV, which is the medium that really matters the most, is there are effective Republican hits being laid on Stacey Abrams, and there are not effective hits going on to Kemp, and that is going to benefit Kemp in the long term. It's going to help him going into September.
Let's move to the controversy now in Randolph County, where the County Elections Board is trying to close 7 of 9 polling places. This has gotten attention around the country. Theron, I'm going to start with you on this one. A lot of the criticism has said, look, okay, this goes back to voter suppression. This is implied blame on the Republicans. But aren't most of the county officials, county commission members, in Randolph County, aren't they Democrats? Although this was the county elections board that was making this move.
Right. And so, you know, Randolph County is a predominantly African-American county, and it's a county that's in rural Georgia. And the argument here is that they're saying the county and this governing board of the elections is saying that I think 7 out of the 9 locations do not meet the American Disability Act requirements. So therefore, they want to close them down.
There's also a funding issue, too.
But they also have a funding issue. And so I think that this, to me, Dennis, is not a Democratic or Republican issue. I think the challenge is that there's a cloud hanging over this state because we know we have a Secretary of State's office that clearly was involved in some purging of voters. For a long time in this state, there's been a lot of concerns about voter suppression, mm-hmm. about voter intimidation, and about, particularly in the rural counties, them not having the necessary funding to basically make sure that people feel confident that their votes are being counted.
But how does this issue, which is a local one, involve the Secretary of State's office, which brings in Brian Kemp, who is the Secretary of State?
It doesn't. It doesn't.
No, it does, because the thing about it is that it all starts at the top. And again, it is a county issue that they have to me, Dennis, I think the messaging is wrong about this. I think this is not one that Democrats should really spend a lot of time talking about. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's denying access. It's reducing the locations and the ability for people to go exercise their right to vote. The reason it's made national news, and back to why I think it involves the Secretary of State's office, is because we know that this president and others in this particular Secretary of State's office has actually been, again, in a lawsuit basically saying that they have been purging voters and that people's data has been released. And so there's this overwhelming stigma out there that people don't feel that their votes are being counted accurately and that the counties and the state are not giving them the opportunities to express their right to vote.
Add me to the growing list of Americans that is sick and tired of every issue being racialized when there's no race at the bottom of the issue. And that is exactly what we have here. This is a local control issue, as Governor Deal said yesterday. This was determined by local officials who, by the way, are African-American. That's the case. This isn't white people in Atlanta saying, hey, we're going to make it harder on a handful of African-Americans to vote, because that's what you're talking about in Randolph County. It's a very small county. This is happening in other parts of the state, and guess what? It's not getting any attention. Why? Because they are Trump counties. Jackson County, up in northeast Georgia, up I-85 corridor, 80% Trump County. They closed a large number of precincts there, and I saw the voter suppression that resulted from it. And it wasn't intimidation. It wasn't you can't go vote. It was because it was just so inconvenient. You know, last year during the special elections for those two Athens area state house seats, one of those districts goes into Jackson County through Barrow, another Republican county. And those closed precincts meant that some of those voters in that district were 20 minutes away from the nearest polling precinct now. And they were telling canvassers, we're not going to vote because they closed our precinct. It's just too far. And you're not hearing any outrage. You're not seeing stories in the New York Times about it. Why? Because it's white people. And it's people who vote for Republicans. So this is not a partisan issue. It's not a racial issue. It's being racialized because everything has got to be cut on that razor's edge now. And it's destructive, but it's not Republicans doing it.
Speaking of racial issues, one issue that has come up this week is the Buford school superintendent, Guy Hamby, who, at least according to a report and apparently in a recording of some phone conversations, went on a racist rant, not just racist but obscene. The school board has placed him on administrative leave. They say they're going to have a specially called meeting soon to take up this issue. Brian, there have constantly been calls from Republicans to say, let's de-racialize issues. Does this show folks why people still say there is a racial problem in our politics and in our governing structures?
This guy's not an elected official. He's an appointed official. He's an employee. The fact that there are racists out there is not news to anybody. I don't think that scandalizes or surprises anybody. But that doesn't mean that every issue inherently is about race. The fact that some guy went out and spewed hateful language, obscene language.
But he's in charge of the school system.
Look, it is concerning. It should be very worrisome and infuriating to the people who live in Buford and maybe even in all of Georgia. And that guy's future is probably not too bright. I mean, not only will he probably get fired if this is proven to be him, that those are his words, it's going to be hard for him to ever get a job again in his chosen profession. There will be a sanction on him. He will be punished for those things. And that is the appropriate response. As somebody who worked on the Cagle campaign, I am a little leery of secret recordings at this juncture. I'm still a little raw with me, you know. I may give the benefit of the doubt to somebody on it. Because as I said often in the wake of the Cagle tapes, if I were secretly recorded, I would be unemployable in any capacity. I would not be hired to mop the floors at Burger King if I were secretly recorded. And I am so tired of the self-righteousness of people who haven't been secretly recorded about those who have. And that does not, I'm not apologizing for what he said. I'm not defending it. You should never use those words.
What I really want to point out here is that this tape that alleges that the superintendent made these very explicit, inappropriate, racist comments about African-American workers, it was basically saying that he wanted to kill black construction workers who had angered him, according to an accusation in a race discrimination lawsuit. And the complaint has been filed in the U.S. District of Atlanta in the court. So here's the thing about why I think this implicit bias and racism exists in the workplace. And as an African-American business owner who actually serves more, have more white clients than I do black clients, I believe that there are white people, not all white people, but some white people who are racist. And the racism comes out, Dennis, when it comes to class and it comes to work. If you look at it right now, what we're going through in this country is that no one is talking about how President Trump's White House is the most corrupt White House in our history. But instead, we're talking about City Hall. We're talking about the Atlanta airport. Where am I going with this? These are agencies. These are companies that are being led by African-Americans. If what this gentleman said is true, and this tape is him, I believe it, because I think that certain white people in this country, when it comes to class, and this is all about him saying that these in, you know, calling the N-word, calling them deadbeat N-word, saying they're lazy and all that stuff. This was started at the top, Dennis. And so now you have people like this gentleman who thinks that it's okay for him to even say it privately, whether or not he's being recorded. I would never say to Brian, and I'm going to take it a step further, because I think this is one of the things about this podcast where people want to get the real. Do I have conversations with some of my black counterparts who talk really, really bad about white people? Absolutely. I do. But let's not act like we don't witness, and you guys as white males don't hear some of your white counterparts say these very things that this gentleman allegedly said. Now, what you choose to do when you hear it is what defines you as a person and your character. And so I think that this is a bad issue, because this gentleman is the superintendent of schools, and he's supposed to be the role model. He is the standard bearer. He is the person who sets the culture and the tone of this school system. These teachers, these school board members, these children all look up to their superintendent. So if he is uttering those words, and if he has that racist hatred in his heart, then he is not fit mentally, nor is he morally sound enough to even be in that position. So I think that, to me, why this is being amplified, that this is a superintendent, this is a noble job that many of us held to a very high standard. And if he felt that way and used those type of words, he should be fired, and he should not be allowed to work in this town ever again.
You know, I do think that there's racism out there, but I do want to respond to what Theron said, because I think that this is insightful, and I want him to know this. In my social circles, I'm sure people do things that their actions are driven to some degree by race, maybe where they put their kids in school, where they choose to live, what restaurants they go to, what bars they go to. I think a lot of that is determined by race, because people are ethnocentric. Whites, blacks, brown, purple, whatever your color, there is a desire, we know through science, that people choose to be with people who are like them culturally. But in my Republican circles, I never hear the N-word. And I think Theron may not believe me on that. But in Washington, in Georgia, during my career, I have never heard that word used in a private office, in a public setting, at a dinner party, at a cocktail party. It is unsaid. So I do think white racism, to some degree, is effectively undercover. It has responded to social pressures over the years. Changing mores have affected it. You do not hear white people use that language, at least not in the circles that I run in.
Dennis, I would bet you a steak dinner that in your 40 years of broadcasting, you have probably spent more time talking about and discussing white people using the N-word than you have from African-American using the word hunky. White trash, trailer park trash, cracker. You have, over your 40 years, I would bet that you have never, ever had to come in and facilitate a conversation from a black leader using those type of words, which
I think the closest it ever came was when Andy Young used the term smart-ass white boys.
Right.
That was the closest it ever came.
And I think that Brian actually embraces the smart-ass white boy terminology, right? Because it allows
you. I have a T-shirt that says that.
Yeah. So my point is, and this is why we got to get deep on this conversation about race. Brian, I think that it definitely happens more with the white community feeling comfortable in saying that about the black community. It, you know, show me the records. I have never, ever discussed a comments that have been made by African-American leaders, especially African-American superintendent, that refer to white people in those terms. And so I think it goes back where maybe you haven't heard the word in your circles. And I kind of believe that. I think that they know who you are and they know your relationship with me and others, that you wouldn't sit there and let that be tolerated. But I do believe that there's an extreme amount of racism amongst some white people that feel comfortable enough to use these words when it comes to issues like immigration, working class Americans.
The reason why you haven't heard about other races saying derogatory things is because there is a double standard in place. White leaders are held to a different set of rules. And anything that they say that's even on the borderline can be blown into a scandal that is not the standard that others are held to. And very few people have been held to the secret recording standard, which is an impossible standard, in my opinion. And I think we have to keep that in mind. I'm not forgiving the use of that word. I think white people and others, I think African Americans should follow suit on this as well, should never say that word. It should be a working rule for everybody.
Yeah, but you can't. No, there's no double standard.
Look, it's a huge double standard.
No, it's not.
That's why Republicans are so mad all the time.
No, it's not. I'm just telling you, as a person of color who spends an intimate amount of time around people of color who are in leadership positions, Brian, that's not our culture. We don't talk like that when we refer to white people. We just don't. But you can't sit up here and say, because the tapes prove it, the evidence prove it. We have presidents who refer to this. We even have Papa John's guy who used the N-word, right? Running big corporations. I mean, I'm just saying, it is a culture among some white people that they feel comfortable enough to refer to us in that way. It's not a double standard. Here's the solution. Don't say it. Don't say it whether you
are. We can agree on that.
Yeah, just don't say it.
Very quickly, this week, the first meeting of the Airport Study Committee in the legislature was held, and this is about the question of whether the state will take over Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, which the city has run like forever. This committee has only one person, Valencia C., a Democratic senator from Riverdale, from any of the areas affected. She's from Clayton County. There isn't anybody, as I looked at it, that was from the city of Atlanta. But, Brian, the first hearing raised the question of whether, because of the big debt that the airport has for big construction purposes, does the state really want to take this on after all these years of state lawmakers saying, gee, we'd love to take that over? Be careful what you wish for.
I don't see this thing moving forward too rapidly. It's something that the committee is perfectly free to study. I think that there are legitimate issues that have been raised in media reports about the contracting systems there and the scandals that have resulted from that. And of course, we had some scandal recently about how the former airport manager left and as it relates to the former mayor Reed. And there's some questions raised about the airport. But what we do know also is it is one of the best run airports in the entire world. It is not only the busiest in the world, but it has won award after award after award for how it is managed, for the food offerings that are there, for the efficiency of it, for how quickly you get your bags at baggage claim. It does extremely well in these ratings, and we need to be careful about changing something that works. And two, as a Republican, I believe that risk takers should reap the rewards of their investments that they took risk on. They took the risk of losing big. The
city, you know, who said that years ago? Democratic House Speaker Tom Murphy.
He's absolutely right. The city of Atlanta put skin in the game, and it has paid off. And I am very leery of a bigger government coming in and finding honey holes from a smaller government and grabbing some of the honey. And secondly, let's remember that major airlines such as Delta obviously is a major employer here, the biggest employer in the state. They are openly and adamantly opposed to a state takeover. We need to take that into consideration.
They are the winner of the 2018 Civil Rights Advocate and Partner Award at the FAA National Civil Rights Training Conference. They're the world's most efficient and effective airport for the 15th year in a row, basically from the Air Transport Research Society. To echo Brian's point, this is not about the personnel and operational challenges to make sure that we enhance this great airport. This is a bunch of Republican legislators sitting over in the Gold Dome who want to figure out a way how they can try to disrupt what has been a great airport that has been run for many, many decades by the city of Atlanta and by the mayoral leadership that's been in place. This study committee was doomed from the beginning, because how can you have a objective conversation about an airport or any entity or authority where you only have one person who actually has a sliver of the actual?
Valencia C. is from Clayton County. The airport's in Clayton
but
County.
But not one single Atlanta delegation, Fulton delegation, person who actually represents the airport and the people who live around the airport. And so let's just call this what it is, Dennis. These state lawmakers, many of whom are Republicans, see all of this money that is going through the airport and saying, wow, how can we control that? Because one thing that we know about the 2018 Republicans, which is these new Trump Republicans, they love to spend, right? And they want to figure out a way how they can generate millions and millions and millions of dollars. Now, Brian has teased me for a very long time saying, Theron, ooh, I would love to get one of those lucrative contracts at the airport, right?
Absolutely. Want right? Popeye's franchise?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Now you have this one senator, Burt Jones, who I like, who is a good person.
He is the chair of the study committee.
Who is the chair of the study commission and who's had the guts to now, I think, a third year to come back and float this idea. But this was something that was endorsed by Casey Cagle. This was something that during the Republican primary, they kind of flirted with talking about it. But I think Brian was smart enough to tell his candidate, and I think Republicans are smart enough to know that you really don't want to have that financial conversation. You really don't want to get into the bonding. And I got to give a guy a lot of credit. Robert Highsmith, I think, did a wonderful job testifying.
A very well-connected attorney who is representing the city in this one.
Right, who's gotten some very unfair, inappropriate, negative press lately, but by doing his job, I think laid it out for 20 minutes about how this airport operationally is one of the best and how the study committee, who really wants to create this governing authority, is not necessary.
One other quick one. Georgia Tech's president, Bud Peterson, said he will make sure that Tech now complies with state ethics policies. This after he got a strong rebuke from the university system chancellor, Steve Wrigley, for what was called by Wrigley lax management and unethical behavior by some of the institute's top officials. Three of them resigned. A fourth was fired after an investigation found cozy relationship with vendors, financial conflicts of interest, among other things. Brian, Bud Peterson is paid over $1 million. This is tops among state college presidents. Does it take something like this to get him to say, you know, we're really, really going to work hard at avoiding financial problems and mismanagement?
Bud Peterson, according to the people who are around him that I know, is a leader who empowers his deputies to go do their areas of expertise and their specialties and doesn't stay on their backs. Now, this is what happens under that management style. A lot of good things can come from that management style, too. The era of Bud Peterson's presidency at Georgia Tech has been revolutionary for that school. It has risen in national prominence. What they're doing right across the bridge there in that tech village mm-hmm. with all these startups is mind-boggling and will have tremendous impact on our economy for decades to come.
And you're saying this is a Georgia Bulldog.
Yeah, now I think Jerry Moorhead should be paid more. The University of Georgia president should make more than Bud Peterson. You know, even if it just as a rebuke for this. And restore our prominence as the number one university in the state where we belong. But Bud has done a great job there. This is obviously a huge problem. And if it doesn't go any deeper, if we don't see this and have a slow drip, drip, drip of more stories, he can survive it. I commend Chancellor Wrigley for stepping in and chastising Peterson and saying this is unacceptable. It's got to change. I think he needed to do that. He needed to lay down the law in case this is happening everywhere else. Let it be a warning to other presidents in the system to keep an eye out for this kind of work.
And Theron, college presidents, not just Bud Peterson, but as we know from Kennesaw State, from UGA in recent years under not just this administration, but previous UGA administrations, college presidents have been in the crosshairs at the legislature lately for all sorts of things. Does this make that job less tenable, and does it put the salaries that they're paid under more scrutiny?
Well, and I'm glad you pointed out, Dennis. I mean, let's not, you know, I'm a Georgia Bulldog fan too, grew up in Athens, spent probably a lot of my time as a young kid growing up in Athens on the campus of UGA. But UGA had their problems, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we forget about that. Yep. Then, boom, here comes Sam Olens, who was a former president of Kennesaw State. Totally misuse of power, data breach. Mm-hmm. I mean, just total incompetence.
Well, and there was the financial questions that were raised about dining hall contracts under the previous administration of Dan Papp.
Exactly. And now, boom, we get to Georgia Tech. So I was really hoping that Brian Robinson was going to come on and say what he says about Atlanta leaders and City Hall leaders, and many of them happen to be African-Americans, that this is just a culture of corruption, right? This is just a culture of people just wanting to just blow all this money. But you don't hear that, right? What you heard from him, which I agree, is, oh, Bud Peterson is this great guy. He's done all these great reformy things. The bottom line is this, Dennis, is that it goes back to our earlier conversation, is that, you know, if you're going to be a critic, be a fair critic. And the bottom line is that what those gentlemen were doing, those people were doing over Georgia Tech, was worse than what we've seen in any of the local county and city things that were done, right? I mean, this was a colossal abuse of funds and power. But I don't see Republicans and many people coming out and basically saying, oh, my God, this is just crazy. We just laid out three major institutions and our state region system that clearly has had some corrupt behavior going on. Now, does it raise questions about the salary? Absolutely. I think that Steve Wrigley, who's a good man who I know very well, came out and did what he had to do. I think that Georgia Tech will recover from this. I think that college presidents, to Brian's point, all across the state have got to really keep an eye on what that particular department that really have a key and pivotal role in the advancement of these institutions, how they're spending money and how it's being managed. But I think this is a big, big deal, but I do think that Georgia Tech will recover, and I think that they've taken some proactive steps to try to rebrand on this issue.
We've been talking about colleges. It's college football season. Brian, you're a Georgia Bulldog. You've got Georgia ranked number 3 in the preseason polls. Do they mean anything? And meanwhile, while we're getting ready for college football, everybody's still interested in the Atlanta Braves. Atlanta United is on top of the MSL, and the Peachtree City Little Leaguers did us proud at Williamsport.
Yes.
I mean, what a time to be a sports fan. What do you think is going to happen in the fall?
I just can't wait. I'm on the edge of my seat to find out how they're all going to break my heart this time. That's where I am as an Atlanta fan. The Dogs won the national championship last year, I think Jerry Moorhead should hang a banner in Sanford Stadium. We were robbed. It was everyone who watched that game knows that that those Big Ten moron refs stole it from us. We won it, and I think we're going to repeat as national champions. Braves aren't going to win the World Series, but they're going to have a fantastic year, and it is going to be a golden era. And if you haven't been to a United game, get there. It is an amazing experience. Kudos to Arthur Blank. It is an amazing experience.
I watched the last game on TV with Columbus. Joseph Martinez, the striker set the record, is awesome. But Almiron, the guy who scored the goal where he went through all of the defense, he is beautiful to watch. I mean, this is a team with a combination of power and finesse that the rest of the league is going to have to watch out for.
I'm very excited about Georgia football. I think that I agree with Brian. I think the team is going to be awesome. And I'll be honest with you, I'm one of the many people that's torn about the NFL right now. At a time where you have this president basically telling these African-American athletes who makes millions and millions of dollars for themselves and their families and also for the NFL that they can't kneel and express their nonviolent First Amendment right towards ending the social injustice that we see in this country, the police brutality. So, and then the Braves, yeah, great. But definitely NFL, I want to say that. I think that a lot of the people that I talk to, Dennis, you're going to see a lot more people not supporting NFL if they do not do more to address this problem.
Absolutely not, because it is not a First Amendment issue. Again, I am just so tired. I'm exhausted with any time a private employer says you cannot represent me in the uniform that I gave you and say whatever you want to say. It's not just a rule for NFL players. It's a rule for all of us. There are things that Theron and I cannot say on this show because we would lose clients, right? It is something that impacts every single person in this country. You've got to think through the consequences of your speech. No one on that field kneeling has been arrested. That is a violation of
but
your First Amendment speech.
But they have been publicly arrested. They have been attacked, and they've been politically—
You have no constitutional right to not be attacked back. You do not have that constitutional right.
I'd say this, Brian. I think that these players who you support, because guess what? If they all decided not to come to work—
They have a Falcons logo, I support.
Yeah, yeah. But no, but I think that to say that they don't have that right— as people who actually go out there and put their lives on line, Donald Trump and Jerry Jones and Arthur Blank, they're not out there playing one down. But these African-American men should be allowed the right to express their freedom of speech during the anthem, when the anthem is on, when it's not. And I tell you, this is one that we totally disagree on. And I'm telling you, I think that as a African-American male who loves football, I am seriously struggling with this, because I think that this president and this NFL has done a tremendous amount of really trying to silence these Americans who we all love to entertain us to basically express their First Amendment right. And it's not about being disrespectful to the military. It's not about being disrespectful to the flag. It's about them using the opportunity to peacefully protest.
And the people who sign their paycheck can say, not on my watch.
And I left out one team that is also doing well. After a rough season last year, the Atlanta Dream getting into the playoffs. So those summertime sports, because the WNBA plays in the summer, they're holding interest even as we move into the fall. Should be a lot of fun.
Winning is fun.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining me today, Republican strategist Brian Robinson, a former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, former National Southern Regional Director of the Obama 2012 campaign. It has been a blast, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
Glad to be back.
And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. And we'll be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.